Edison, the early years. Abridged from Edison, his life and inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. It was at the Port Huron Public School that Edison received all the regular scholastic instruction he ever enjoyed. Just 3 months. He might have spent the full term there, but his teacher had found him addled. He was always, according to his own recollection, at the foot of the class, and had come almost to regard himself as a dunce, while his father entertained vague anxieties as to his stupidity. The truth of the matter seems to be that Mrs. Edison, a teacher of uncommon ability and force, held no very high opinion of the average public school methods and results, and was both eager to undertake the instruction of her son and ambitious for the future of a boy whom she knew from pedagogic experience to be receptive and thoughtful to a very unusual degree. With her he found study easy and pleasant. The quality of culture in that simple but refined home, as well as the intellectual character of this youth without schooling, may be inferred from the fact that before he had reached the age of 12 he had read, with his mother's help, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Hume's History of England, Sears' History of the World, Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, and the Dictionary of Sciences, and had even attempted to struggle through Newton's Principia, whose mathematics were decidedly beyond both teacher and student. Besides, Edison, like Faraday, was never a mathematician, and has had little personal use for arithmetic beyond that which he called mental. He said once to a friend, "I can always hire some mathematicians, but they can't hire me." His father, by the way, always encouraged these literary tastes and paid him a small sum for each new book mastered. It will be noted that fiction makes no showing in the list, but it was not altogether excluded from the home library. And Edison has all his life enjoyed it, particularly the works of such writers as Victor Hugo, after whom, because of his enthusiastic admiration, possibly also because of his imagination, he was nicknamed by his fellow operators Victor Hugo Edison. Electricity at that moment could have no allure for a youthful mind. Crude telegraphy represented what was known of it practically, and about that the books read by young Edison were not redundantly informational. Even had that not been so, the inclination of the boy, barely 10 years old, were toward chemistry, and 50 years later there is seen no chance of predilection. It sounds like heresy to say that Edison became an electrician by chance, but it is the sober fact that to this preeminent and brilliant leader in electrical achievement, escape into the chemical domain still has the aspect of a delightful truant holiday. One of the earliest stories about his boyhood relates to the incident when he induced a lad employed in the family to swallow a large quantity of Seidlitz powders in the belief that the gases generated would enable him to fly. The agonies of the victim attracted attention, and Edison's mother marked her displeasure by an application of the switch kept behind the old Seth Thomas grandfather clock. The disastrous result of this experiment did not discourage Edison at all, as he attributed failure to the lad rather than to the motive power. In the cellar of the Edison homestead, young Alva soon accumulated a chemical outfit, constituting the first in a long series of laboratories. The word laboratory had always been associated with alchemists in the past, but as with filament, this untutored stripling applied an iconoclastic particularity to it long before he realized the significance of the new departure. The home at Port Huron thus saw the first Edison laboratory. The boy began experimenting when he was about 10 or 11 years of age. He got a copy of Parker's School Philosophy, an elementary book on physics, and about every experiment in it he tried. Young Alva, or Al as he was called, thus early displayed his great passion for chemistry, And in the cellar of the house he collected no fewer than 200 bottles gleaned in baskets from all parts of the town. These were arranged carefully on shelves and all labeled poison, so that no one else would handle or disturb them. They contained the chemicals with which he was constantly experimenting. To others, this diversion was both mysterious and meaningless, but he had soon become familiar with all the chemical obtainable at the local drugstores and had tested to his satisfaction many of the statements encountered in his scientific reading. Edison has said that sometimes he has wondered how it was he did not become an analytical chemist instead of concentrating on electricity, for which he had at first no great inclination. Such pursuits as these consumed the scant pocket money of the boy very rapidly. He was not in regular attendance at school and had read all the books within reach. It was thus he turned newsboy, overcoming the reluctance of his parents, particularly that of his mother, by pointing out that he could by this means earn all he wanted for his experiments and get fresh reading in the shape of papers and magazines free of charge. Besides his leisure hours in Detroit, he would be able to spend at the public library. He applied in 1859 for the privilege of selling newspapers on the trains of the Grand Trunk Railroad between Port Huron and Detroit, and obtained the concession after a short delay, during which he made an essay in his task of selling newspapers. Edison had, in fact, already had some commercial experience from the age of 11. The 10 acres of the reservation offered an excellent opportunity for truck farming, and the versatile head of the family could not avoid trying his luck at this branch of work. A large market garden was laid out in which Edison worked pretty steadily with the help of the Dutch boy Michael Oates. These boys had a horse and small wagon entrusted to them, and every morning in the season they would load up with onions, lettuce, peas, etc., and go through the town. As much as $600 was turned over to Mrs. Edison in 1 year from this source. The boy was indefatigable, but not altogether charmed with agriculture. After a while, I tired of this work, as hoeing corn in the hot sun is unattractive, and I did not wonder that it had built up cities. Soon the Grand Trunk Railroad was extended from Toronto to Port Huron at the foot of Lake Huron, and thence to Detroit at about the same time the War of Rebellion broke out. By a great amount of persistence, I got permission from my mother to go on the local train as a newsboy. The local train from Port Huron to Detroit, a distance of 63 miles, left at 7 a.m. and arrived again at 9:30 p.m. After being on the train for several months, I started 2 stores in Port Huron, one for periodicals and the other for vegetables, butter, and berries in the season. They were attended by 2 boys who shared in the profits. The periodical store I soon closed, as the boy in charge could not be trusted. The vegetable store I kept for nearly a year. After the railroad had been opened a short time, they put on an express which left Detroit in the morning and returned in the evening. I received permission to put a newsboy on this train. Connected with the railroad was a car, one part for baggage and the other for parts of U.S. mail. But for a long time it was not used. Every morning I had 2 large baskets of vegetables from the Detroit market loaded in the mail car and sent to Port Huron, where the boy would take them to the store. They were much better than those grown locally and sold readily. I never was asked to pay freight, and to this day cannot explain why, except that I was so small and industrious, and the nerve to appropriate a U.S. mail car to do the free freight business was so monumental. However, I kept this up for a long time, and in addition bought butter from the farmers along the line and an immense amount of blackberries in the season. I bought wholesale at a low price and permitted the wives of the engineers and trainmen to have the benefit of the discount. After a while, there was a daily immigrant train put on. This train generally had from 7 to 10 coaches filled always with Norwegians, all bound for Iowa and Minnesota. On these trains I employed a boy who sold bread, tobacco, and stick candy. As the war progressed, the daily newspaper sales became very profitable, and I gave up the vegetable store. The train was made up of three coaches, baggage, smoking, and ordinary passengers or ladies. The baggage car was divided into three compartments, one for trunks and packages, one for mail, and one for smoking. In those days, no use was made of the smoking compartment, as there was no ventilation, and it was turned over to young Edison, who not only kept papers there and his stock of goods as candy butcher, but soon had it equipped with an extraordinary variety of apparatus. There was plenty of leisure on the two daily runs, even for an industrious boy, and thus he found time to transfer his laboratory from the cellar and reestablish it on the train. His earnings were also excellent, so good, in fact, that $8 or $10 a day were often taken in, and $1 went every day to his mother. Thus supporting himself, he felt entitled to spend any other profit left over on chemicals and apparatus. And spent it was, for with access to Detroit and its large stores where he bought his supplies, and the public library where he could quench his thirst for technical information, Edison gave up all his spare time and money to chemistry. Nor did this amazing equipment stop at batteries and bottles. The same little space a few feet square was soon converted by this precocious youth into a newspaper office. The outbreak of the Civil War gave a great stimulus to the demand for all newspapers, noticing which he became ambitious to publish a local journal of his own, devoted to the news of that section of the Grand Trunk Road. A small printing press that had been used for hotel bills of fare was picked up in Detroit, and type was also bought, some of it being placed on the train so that composition could go on in spells of leisure. To one so mechanical in his tastes as Edison, it was quite easy to learn the rudiments of the printing art, and thus the Weekly Herald came into existence, of which he was compositor, pressman, editor, publisher, and newsdealer. Only one or two copies of this journal are now discoverable. The literary style is good. There are only a few trivial slips in spelling, and the appreciation is keen of what would be interesting news and gossip. The price was 3 cents a copy or 8 cents a month for regular subscribers, and the circulation ran to over 400 copies an issue. This was by no means the result of mere public curiosity, but it tested the value of the sheet as a genuine newspaper, to which many persons in the railroad service along the line were willing contributors. Indeed, with the aid of the railroad telegraph, Edison was often able to print late news of importance, of local origin, that the distant regular papers, like those of Detroit, which he handled as a newsboy, could not get. It is no wonder that this clever little sheet received the approval and patronage of the English engineer Stephenson when inspecting the Grand Trunk system, and was noted by no less distinguished a contemporary than the London Times as the first newspaper in the world to be printed on a train in motion. The youthful proprietor sometimes cleared as much as $20 to $30 a month from this unique journalistic enterprise. But all this extra work required attention, and Edison solved the difficulty of attending also to the newsboy business by the employment of a young friend, whom he trained and treated literally as an understudy. There was often plenty of work for both in the early days of the war, when the news of battle caused intense excitement and a large sale of papers. Edison, with native shrewdness already so strikingly displayed, would telegraph the station agents and get them to bulletin the event of the day at the front, so that when each station was reached there were eager purchasers waiting. He recalls in particular the sensation caused by the great Battle of Shiloh, or Pittsburgh Landing, in April 1862, in which both Grant and Sherman were engaged, in which Johnson died, and in which there was a ghastly total of 25,000 killed and wounded. In describing his enterprising action that day, Edison says that when he reached Detroit, the bulletin boards of the newspaper offices were surrounded with dense crowds, which read awe-stricken the news that there were 60,000 killed and wounded, and that the result was uncertain. I knew that if the same excitement was attained at the various small towns along the road, and especially at Port Huron, the sale of papers would be great. I then conceived the idea of telegraphing the news ahead, went to the operator in the depot, and by giving him Harper's Weekly and some other papers for 3 months, he agreed to telegraph to all the stations the matter on the bulletin board. I hurriedly copied it, and he sent it, requesting the agents to display it on the blackboards used for stating the arrival and departure of trains. I decided that instead of the usual 100 papers, I could sell 1,000. But not having sufficient money to purchase that number, I determined in my desperation to see the editor himself and get credit. The great paper at that time was the Detroit Free Press. I walked into the office marked editorial and told a young man I wanted to see the editor on important business, important to me anyway. I was taken into an office where there were two men, and I stated what I had done about telegraphing and that I wanted 1,000 papers, but only had money for 300, and I wanted credit. One of the men refused it, but the other told the first spokesman to let me have them. This man, I afterward learned, was William F. Story, who subsequently founded the Chicago Times and became celebrated in the newspaper world. By the aid of another boy, I lugged the papers to the train and started folding them. The first station, called Utica, was a small one where I generally sold 2 papers. I saw a crowd ahead on the platform and thought it was some excursion, but the moment I landed there was a rush for me and I realized that the telegraph was a great invention. I sold 35 papers there. The next station was Mount Clemens, now a watering place, but then a town of about 1,000. I usually sold 6 to 8 papers there. I decided that if I found a corresponding crowd there, the only thing to do to correct my lack of judgment in not getting more papers was to raise the price from 5 cents to 10. The crowd was there, and I raised the price. At the various towns, there were corresponding crowds. It had been my practice at Port Huron to jump from the train at a point about 1/4 of a mile from the station, where the train generally slackened speed. I had drawn several loads of sand at this point to jump on, and I had become quite expert. The little Dutch boy with the horses met me at this point. When the wagon approached the outskirts of the town, I was met by a large crowd. I then yelled, 25 cents apiece, gentlemen. I haven't got enough to go around. I sold all out and made what was to me then an immense sum of money. Such episodes as this added materially to his income, but did not necessarily increase his savings, for he was then as now an utter spendthrift as long as some new apparatus or supplies for experiment could be had. In fact, the laboratory on wheels soon became crowded with such equipment. Most costly chemicals were bought on the installment plan. George Pullman, who then had a small shop at Detroit, was working on his sleeping car and made Edison a lot of wooden apparatus for his chemicals, to the boy's delight. Unfortunately, a sudden change came, fraught with disaster. The train running one day at 30 miles an hour over a piece of poorly laid track was thrown suddenly out of the perpendicular with a violent lurch, and before Edison could catch it, a stick of phosphorus was jarred from its shelf, fell to the floor, and burst into flame. The car took fire, and the boy, in dismay, was soon trying to quench the blaze when the conductor, a quick-tempered Scotsman who acted also as baggage master, hastened to the scene with water and saved his car. On arrival at Mount Clemens Station, its next stop, Edison and his entire outfit, laboratory, printing plant, and all were promptly ejected by the enraged conductor, and the train then moved off, leaving him on the platform, tearful and indignant, in the midst of his beloved but ruined possessions. It was lynch law of a kind, but in view of the responsibility, this action of the conductor lay well within his rights and duties. It was through this incident that Edison acquired the deafness that has persisted all through his life, a severe box on the ears from the scorched and angry conductor being the direct cause of the infirmity. Although this deafness would be regarded as a great affliction by most people, Mr. Edison has always regarded it philosophically and said about it recently, "This deafness has been of great advantage to me in various ways. When in a telegraph office, I could only hear the instrument directly on the table at which I sat, and unlike the other operators, I was not bothered by the other instruments. Again, in experimenting on the telephone, I had to improve the transmitter so I could hear it. This made the telephone commercial, as the magnetotelephone receiver of Bell was too weak to be used as a transmitter commercially. It was the same with the phonograph. The great defect of that instrument was the rendering of the overtones in music and the hissing consonants in speech. I worked over 1 year, 20 hours a day, Sundays and all, to get the word specie perfectly recorded and reproduced on the phonograph. When this was done, I knew that everything else could be done. Again, my nerves have been preserved intact. Broadway is as quiet to me as a country village is to a person with normal hearing." Saddened but not wholly discouraged, Edison soon reconstituted his laboratory and printing office at home. But Edison promised not to bring in anything of a dangerous nature. He did not cease the publication of the Weekly Herald. On the contrary, he prospered in both his enterprises until persuaded by the printer's devil in the office of the Port Huron Commercial to change the character of his journal, enlarge it, and issue it under the name of Paul Pry, a happy designation for this or kindred ventures in the domain of society journalism. No copies of Paul Pry can now be found. In Detroit, he spent frequent hours in the public library, and it is a matter of record that he began his liberal acquaintance with its contents by grappling bravely with a certain section and trying to read it through consecutively, shelf by shelf, regardless of subject. In a way, this is curiously suggestive of the earnest, energetic method of frontal attack with which the inventor has since addressed himself to so many problems in the arts and sciences. The Grand Trunk Railroad machine shops at Port Huron were a great attraction to the boy, who appears to have spent a good deal of his time there. He who was to have so much to do with the evolution of the modern electric locomotive was fascinated by the mechanism of the steam locomotive, and whenever he could get a chance, Edison rode in the cab with the engineer of his train. He became thoroughly familiar with the intricacies of firebox, boiler, valves, levers, and gears, and liked nothing better than to handle the locomotive himself during the run. On one trip, when the engineer lay asleep while his eager substitute piloted the train, the boiler primed and a deluge overwhelmed the young driver, who stuck to his post till the run and the ordeal were ended. Edison's own account of the incident is very laughable. The engine was one of a number leased to the Grand Trunk by the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy. It had bright brass bands all over and the woodwork beautifully painted, and everything highly polished, which was the custom up to the time old Commodore Vanderbilt stopped it on his roads. After running about 15 miles, the fireman couldn't keep his eyes open. This event followed an all-night dance of the trainman's fraternal organization, and he agreed to permit me to run the engine. I took charge, reducing the speed to about 12 miles an hour, and brought the train of 7 cars to her destination at the Grand Trunk Junction safely. But something occurred which was very much out of the ordinary. I was very much worried about the water, and I knew that if it got low, the boiler was likely to explode. I hadn't gone 20 miles before black, damp mud blew out of the stack and covered every part of the engine, including myself. I was about to awake the fireman to find out the cause of this when it stopped. Then I approached a station where the fireman always went to the cow catcher, opened the oil cup on the steam chest, and poured oil in it. I started to carry out the procedure when, upon opening the oil cup, the steam rushed out with a tremendous noise, nearly knocking me off the engine. I succeeded in closing the oil cup and got back in the cab and made up my mind that she would pull through without oil. I learned afterward that the engineer always shut off the steam when the fireman went out to oil. This point I failed to notice. My powers of observation were very much improved after this occurrence. Just before I reached the junction, another outpour of black mud occurred, and the whole engine was a sight. So much so that when I pulled into the yard, everybody turned to see it laughing immoderately. I found the reason of the mud was that I carried so much water it passed over into the stack, and this washed out all the accumulated soot. One afternoon, about a week before Christmas, Edison's train jumped the track near Utica, a station on the line. Four old Michigan Central cars with rotten sills collapsed in the ditch and went all to pieces, distributing figs, raisins, dates, and candies all over the track and the vicinity. Hating to see so much waste, Edison tried to save all he could by eating it on the spot. But as a result, our family doctor had the time of his life with me in this connection. When Edison was a newsboy on the train, a request came to him one day to go to the office of E.B. Ward & Company, at that time the largest owners of steamships on the Great Lakes. The captain of their largest boat had died suddenly, and they wanted a message taken to another captain who lived about 14 miles from Ridgeway Station on the railroad. This captain had retired, taken up some lumber land, and had cleared part of it. Edison was offered $15 by Mr. Ward to go and fetch him, but as it was a wild country and would be dark, Edison stood out for $25, so that he could get the companionship of another lad. The terms were agreed to. Edison arrived at Ridgeway at 8:30 p.m., when it was raining and dark as ink. Getting another boy with difficulty to volunteer, he launched out on his errand in the pitch-black night. The two boys carried lanterns, but the road was a rough path through dense forest. The country was wild, and it was a usual occurrence to see deer, bear, and coon skins nailed up on the sides of houses to dry. Edison had read about bears, but couldn't remember whether they were day or night prowlers. The farther they went, the more apprehensive they became, and every stump in the ravished forest looked like a bear. The other lad proposed seeking safety up a tree, but Edison demurred on the plea that bears could climb, and that message must be delivered that night to enable the captain to catch the morning train. First one lantern went out, then the other. We leaned up against a tree and cried. I thought if I ever got out of that scrape alive, I would know more about the habits of animals and everything else, and be prepared for all kinds of mischance when I undertook an enterprise. However, the intense blackness dilated the pupils of our eyes so as to make them very sensitive, and we could just see at times the outlines of the road. Finally, just as a faint gleam of daylight arrived, we entered the captain's yard and delivered the message. In my whole life I never spent such a night of horror as this, but I got a good lesson. Another incident of the period is as follows. After selling papers at Port Huron, which was not often reached until about 9:30 at night, I seldom got home before 11 or 11:30. About halfway home from the station and the town, and within 25 feet of the road in a dense wood, was a soldier's graveyard, where 300 soldiers were buried due to a cholera epidemic which took place at Fort Gratiot nearby many years previously. At first we used to shut our eyes and run the horse past this graveyard, and if the horse stepped on a twig, my heart would give a violent movement, and it's a wonder that I haven't got some valvular disease of that organ. But soon the running of the horse became monotonous, and after a while all fears of graveyards absolutely disappeared from my system. I was in the condition of Sam Houston, the pioneer and founder of Texas, who, it was said, knew no fear. Houston lived some distance from the town and generally went home late at night, having to pass through a dark cypress swamp over a corduroy road. One night, to test his alleged fearlessness, a man stationed himself behind a tree and enveloped himself in a sheet. He confronted Houston suddenly, and Sam stopped and said, "If you're a man, you can't hurt me. If you're a ghost, you don't want to hurt me. And if you're the devil, come home with me. I married your sister."